This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known people about their lives, their careers, and navigating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Paley-Phillips, and with me, with his brand new pink chair, is Jim Daly.
Yeah, I have got a brand new pink, sounds like a euphemism of some sort.
Like Papa's got a brand new bag.
Exactly, yeah.
Daly's got a brand new chair.
It's a very comfy chair. I can't. From Habitat. Oh, God. That's the most middle class thing I've ever said. It's a Habitat chair. It's very nice. And I put it together myself, which took literally all day. But I'm quite proud of myself because I'm not a DIY person at all. And I've made this happen. And so far, the wheel has only fallen off once. So I'd say that's pretty successful.
Stuck back on with blue tack. Habitat's an interesting one, isn't it? Because they used to have loads of stores. We used to have one in Brighton, the Habitat. And then I think they got kind of rebranded as Shabitat by consumers because fell apart. It was cool. I've got to go into the history of Habitat now. I think it was the designer Conran that was big kind of... It was his company, I think. Anyway, they've come back into life. I think they sort of went away and now they... I think other stores are stocking their stuff, and obviously you can get stuff online now, so that's great.
So if they want to sponsor the podcast,
yeah, they won't call you Shabitat.
No, we won't. We'll think of a better copy there. But yeah, I'm in my nice new chair, feeling comfy. I'm not breaking my back now. It's only been a year that I've been looking for a new chair.
I'm not breaking wind.
I'm not. Well, I might be. You don't know. I can eat myself. That's a weird image. Anyway, but I'm feeling good. It's an ergonomic chair, so obviously, hopefully, that means it'll help my back feel better and stuff. So I'm feeling quite good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah.
I know you've got a nice chair because we've spoken about chairs many times before. Yeah, yeah. So I've seen it, and I looked at a chair similar to yours actually, and there was one similar one there.
I guess mine's a little bit more kind of businessy looking, like corporate.
I'd say yours is actually more stylish. I think
well, it's a bit more. Yeah, it's probably more 50s. I think it was actually said it was more of a 50s deco style.
If I walked in,
this is terrible for the listeners because they can't actually see.
Yeah, if I walked into the lobby of quite a posh hotel, I wouldn't be surprised to see your chair.
Okay.
There, does that make sense? Like sort of like quite a fancy.
I think the manager of the hotel's probably got one of these chairs.
Yeah, yeah. You've got a real strong manager vibe about you at the moment.
Come into my office. You're fired.
The Alan Sugar of the Blank podcast, which I guess makes me the Karen Brady. I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't watch it.
No, not at all.
Anyway, we've got a wonderful guest on this week, comedian Vic Slayton, who is absolutely fantastic. And it's a really, I'd almost say life-affirming episode, this actually, because we talk a lot about jobs and boundaries and making changes in your life. And I think it's a lot of stuff that anyone who in any industry listening would be able to relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love Vic. She's such a great person. And you and I have both been guests on Comedy Arcade, which is her brilliant podcast.
Yeah, do listen to it. It's a fantastic,
yeah, it's
fantastic
really great
podcast.
And yeah, and it's just fascinating talking to Vix, because obviously she's sort of come into comedy quite late on, in her sort of mid to late 30s, and you know, just negotiating the industry. And obviously she talks about a lot of the obviously the pitfalls of it, but also the supportive networks that are within it as well, which is really great to hear actually, because a lot of creative industries you don't hear that so much, so it's really lovely that comedy people sort of do kind of help each other out, which is really lovely. And she's just a lovely person. It's really, really nice to talk to her.
Really easy to talk to. I mean, this hour and something flies by, because she's just so easy to talk to, and very engaging and very funny, and just and a great storyteller. So I think you can get a vibe from what her stand-up's like as well from this episode as well. So if she's playing near you, do go and check her out. I believe she said, I hope it's okay to say this, that her Brighton Fringe tickets will be on sale now by the time this episode has gone live. So she is performing at the Walrus in Brighton. Do go check it out. I'm guessing from her website, or just Google Vix Layton or find her on Twitter. I'm sure details are there, but do go and check her out. If I could also do a bit of promo for my Museum of Comedy gig, Giles, because that is this week, this Thursday.
Yes.
7 p.m. at the Museum of Comedy, Thursday 24th of March. Please do come along. I'm doing my solo show, the same show that I'm taking to Edinburgh this year, hopefully, and that I did a few times last year. It's called Jim Daly Football and Fatherhood, and it's about football and fatherhood. That's what it says in the tin. But it's a sort of sweet, heartwarming show, I think. It's how I've tried to write it, and I'm very proud of it. So tickets are £8 for Museum of Comedy, or 2 for £12, which is what a discount that is, if you use the discount code Cascarino, as in Tony Cascarino.
What a great
for
discount code name.
Yeah. And it all is explained, Giles. I know you've seen the show. It all is explained, the Cascarino thing in the show. But yeah, put that in the discount code at the Museum of Comedy website, and you'll get two tickets for £12. So that's at museumofcomedy.com. And then you just go to What's On and scroll down to March 24th. And I am there. So please do come along. If you're London-based, it would be lovely to see you.
Definitely. Definitely go. It's a brilliant show.
Thanks, man.
That rhymes.
There you go. Should have got used to the marketing. Shall we, speaking of marketing, do a really quick... Well, I'm going to do a tweet, but I think you've got some Amazon book reviews.
Yeah, we thought we'd do some reviews this week, because for those who might not know, maybe new listeners or people that haven't decided to invest in a book recently, well, we've got a book. It's called Blank, Why It's Fine to Fall to and Fail and How to Pick Yourself Up Again. You can buy it in all good bookshops. You could also get the audio book in all good audio places,
bookstores.
you can if you want to hear us reading it, you can, or you can buy the book if you want the traditional route. But yeah, we thought it'd be quite nice to read out a couple of reviews we've got here.
Yeah, go for it.
This one's from Anya Marsh. She says, okay, I'm a busy person. I've literally no spare time on my hands, so reading books takes me a bit longer than it should, except this one. This one I read in one night. I could not put it down, to the annoyance of everyone who required my attention. It is absolutely brilliant, thought-provoking, but not in a heavy way. A must read and reread and reread. Definite 5 stars.
Whoa. I think that's my favourite review we've ever had for anything.
Yeah.
Because that's such a relatable review, because I feel the same way about the sort of time as well. But yeah, thank you so much. That's lovely to hear.
Yeah, I'd like to read one more if I can. This is Karen Andrews. She says, the topic is a cozy blanket for the soul. She says, I've never really read a book like this before. Most of my literature shows the bad side of humanity. This book is all about the good. Life is pretty awful right now, and this book is a shining light in the darkness and a good giggle.
Oh, lovely. Wow, this is some lovely reviews.
Yeah.
That's so nice. I'm glad
maybe we should
really
do this every week.
Probably should do, actually. It's a nice little confidence booster. I've got a tweet here from Chanel Titterington. Great name. Yeah. And she says, I'm really enjoying Blank Pod. There's been some great guests on that have been relatable and extremely interesting. Phil Wang made me chuckle. Plus, I love finding a diverse grocery shop. Yes. And Russell Peters is hilarious. So lots of things that have resonated with Chanel. And then she's tweeted a photo of her with a can of, can you remember what Phil was talking about?
Began with an M.
Milo.
Milo, that's
or
it.
Or Milo, I don't know.
It's green, is it
right.
Green? It's green.
Yeah, it's green.
Yeah.
And she's put PS, not bought in Peckham, because I know Phil was talking about his favourite diverse shop in Peckham. But yeah, so Chanel, thank you. That's a lovely tweet. Really appreciate you getting in contact.
Yes, thank you, Chanel. Yeah, so if anyone does want to get in contact, they can. They can ping us a message at our various different handles. normally starting with Blank Pod.
That, well, they're all the same, aren't they?
Yeah.
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all at Blank Pod. And that's how to get in contact with us.
Yeah.
So we'd love to hear, you know, any bits you've enjoyed from any episode, please do get in contact. But this is an episode I'm sure you're going to love as well. This is the one and only Vic Slayton on the Blank Podcast.
By staying in the meeting, you consent to be recorded. All right, then.
Is that a new thing? Because I think because I feel like I always host the Zoom meetings. And then the other day I was a sort of a guest on a Zoom meeting and I had to press that button. I didn't realise that came up.
Only when you're recording, so not when you're just part of the meeting. Chatting. It's just so people can't like catch you out, I guess.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I just clicked OK. I didn't read it. I never read anything that pops up ever. So I don't know what I like, agreed to.
We've just found out all your bank details. Would you like to allow this transaction?
Giles, good luck to you. Good luck to you if you found my bank details.
I actually do have your bank details.
Yeah, you actually genuinely do. So
that
do
loads of charity standing orders.
Yeah, it's a fucking, it's a wasteland.
We're all quite liberal with our bank details with comedy. I'm just always so grateful that anyone wants to pay me anything at all. I'm like, yeah, here they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, same. Although you always go down the cash in hand route if you can. Always
send me my £7.
Yeah. Give me that envelope with £3 in it, please.
Oh, I love it. I love having money pressed into my hand. Oh, it feels like the envelope at the end of the
night is
like,
so good.
I do miss, in some respects, I used to do a cleaning job and actually getting a little pay packet with all the... like workings out on
the
it.
Pennies. Yeah.
And it was, I remember the person that did it in like, they wrote it by hand as well. It wasn't printed or anything.
Wow.
So they do.
You've aged yourself so badly there.
You know what though? I was talking yesterday about allocated on arrival holidays. Remember we used to just go, pay £400. Just roll the dice. See what happens when you turn up. That used to be a thing. There was teletext holidays. And then what followed teletext holidays.
Now we're going back.
Was allocated on arrival, where you had, it said, it's definitely got an outdoor pool, it's 3-star, it's going to be this, and you had to get on this like coach and play roulette, and you'd pull up to really nice hotels, and your parents would be all like, my parents would be like twitching, like, is this us? And inevitably it wasn't. It was like some kind of murder shed right at the end.
Just drive
like,
on.
Oh, look, it's the beach. It's like, oh, we go back to the airport. Like, why did, in this era now of like TripAdvisor, the idea that we just thought, sure. Give it a whirl. What's the worst that can happen?
I guess it adds a bit of excitement to your holiday, doesn't it? Adds a little bit of frisson.
Yeah, not the right kind, though, because you really won. The reason that these allocated on arrival hotels existed is because it was to fill like inventory that wasn't full. So it's the ones that nobody wanted in the brochure.
Yeah. It was a spare store cupboard. They were like, fuck it, we can get £300 out of this one.
So people would say, oh, you're not working class because you went on foreign holidays. It's like, no, we paid the price of Butlins for some completely random murder destination somewhere in mainland Spain. So
look, there's nothing wrong with Butlins.
It's overpriced for what it is, though.
It is overpriced, but you do get the entertainment.
Butlins comes up ridiculously often on this podcast. It's amazing how often Butlins is suddenly mentioned by someone.
I don't remember. It is interesting that it comes up a lot. Maybe
it really does.
Maybe a lot of our guests have appeared at Butlins.
Not yet, but if I work hard and try my best,
the children were really young, we used to go to Butlins quite a lot with them. I mean, the entertainment is shite.
But it's knowingly shite, isn't it? You're all in on the joke, basically. Yeah. If you weren't paying £8 a pint, you wouldn't mind. It's just...
I don't know if some of the performers were in on the joke, actually. I think some of the performers were quite... I think they took it quite seriously, some of them. Some of them, not all of them, but I think some of them.
It's a living.
It's a living, and I guess it's
not. There's far worse things to do.
Yeah,
it was a sort of well-trodden path, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of performers. So who knows where they are now? Who knows where those people that you saw at Butlins are now, Charles?
My mum was at Butlins Redcoat. apparently she was working there when Elvis died. I don't think the timelines match up, but in her mind, it is bang on truth. My mum is a self-gaslighter of the highest order.
Made it sound like Elvis died in Butlins, sure isn't true.
She was there the night he died. Yeah, he was doing Hound Dog.
She used to work in a club in Cardiff called the Top Rank, and the act she told me appeared there, and some of them are true, but some of them she's just completely just fabricated from maybe hearing stories about it, and she genuinely believes it. She's a brilliant raconteur, my mum, but yeah, she's a faulty witness. So she's like, yeah, Diana Ross and the Supremes came one week. I was like, did they?
Yeah, but I find
Michael Jackson. I was like, yeah.
Elvis died. I sometimes do that. But not on purpose. Or sometimes someone will say something like, do you remember when that happened? And I'm like, did it? And so sometimes my mind is so bad, I can't. So I can imagine getting to a space where you do start to sort of like tell stories like that and half think like, that could have happened. I just can't remember. I don't know if it's just a memory thing.
Yeah, so she's brilliant. She's a good fan.
Can I ask, has she still got her red coat? Was she able to keep it?
I don't think she has. We've been through several house moves.
Because it feels like you should be able to just have that forever.
Just pass it down like a legacy, like a knighthood in the family. Just like take on the red coat, turn up at any Butlins and be like, I am allowed to perform. This is my heritage. This is my birthright. You let me on.
But it should be like for like a free admission almost. You know, you're in the inner circle.
Maybe. Yeah. I did a gig in Bognor Regis the other day. So I've had a lot.
That's the Butlins that I've been to. Yeah.
That's the iconic Butlins. Yeah. So yeah, it's
How did
so
you
people like in Butlins? I was like, no, in a pub. No.
Yeah, how did you find Bognor? Because Jim went there recently as well.
I only went, I literally went to the venue and then back again in one night.
That's probably the best way to do it, honest.
It's one of those weird ones. And it was good and it was good fun. But because I don't have a car and I also can't drive, so even if I had a car, that would not help me in this scenario. You rely a lot on lifts from other comedians to get to out-of-town gigs. And as a woman in comedy, you have to sort of go about and ask people and be like, guys, firstly, is this person fun in the car? Will I enjoy 2 hours with them? And secondly, are they all right? Because it's such a weird scenario to be in as a woman, where you just have to kind of gamble on these lifts. And you know, almost all comedians and people are fine and they're really good fun. They might be boring in the car, so the answer to question A might not always be the right answer. It might be like, no, take a podcast, take some talking points, because it's going to be dry. But it's a weird thing that you kind of have to ask these questions now to sort of safeguard yourself. But it's a funny old time to be a woman in general, I think, not just a woman in comedy, but it's one of those jobs where you notice it more starkly because you do a lot of late night gigs and you just get paired with people, really. Yeah. And it's like, oh, well, this person's driving, so just hop in that car. And then you catastrophize because obviously the news has been awful over the last 18 months. And you're like, oh, the worst case scenario is this could happen to me. I'm trusting a stranger effectively, but yeah, fortunately, there are sort of good networks in place where you can just sort of double check everyone. And even people that you think that there's absolutely no reason to doubt, you've got to be doing these checks. So
yeah,
it's quite depressing that you can't trust.
Yeah.
Just trust, like, the worst that's going to happen is we've got nothing in common and they're going to tell me that vaccinations will make me an alien. Like
that. And you'll take that. You're like, I'll take that. It's like, okay. Yes. Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's not the experience of blokes basically in comedy. I think I've never had to, when I was getting lifts, never had to worry about that. And then once I decided to start driving to gigs, I mean, I sort of like being on my own anyway, but like it was just giving me sort of like the power to do that. But I remember I drove Sophie Hagen to a gig years ago in Cardiff. They were a great passenger and we chatted loads and really got on well. But I remember they said to me, I asked around beforehand about Jim Daly, hadn't met before.
Yeah.
And the feedback I got was, Jim is the nicest guy in comedy. And I remember thinking at the time, that's great. Didn't say funniest, but I'll take it.
That all the time. I get like, oh, you work really hard. And I'm like, no, I don't want to be seen as someone who works hard. I want to be seen as someone who's effortlessly good. Like this is not the positive feedback you think it is. Because I am obviously in comedy, so I am deeply flawed as a human being, so I can't take things in the spirit that they're intended. So
exactly. All we want to be is, all we want is just to be told we're funny. We don't want literally, that is all we, it's not
none
difficult.
Of the soft skills, please. No. I don't care that I'm fun in the green room. No. Just no. That's
literally.
Not
and the times you are, you really cling on to it. When someone says, like, oh, you were really funny tonight. I think about that for weeks. Like, it's just like, you really can. That's all we want. We are fragile beings. And we just want a little bit of love.
But like 100 people could say to you, yeah, you did great. And then one person will be like, it's not for me, but you know, hope you had a good night. And that'll be the one that I think about.
Yeah. Oh, or, nice. Or they go, you look like you were really enjoying that.
And you think, no, your material was really interesting.
Yeah. Did you have fun up there? Well, now I didn't. No, thanks very much for that backhandy slap. So, yeah.
But Vix, you've come into comedy sort of fairly, I'm not gonna, fairly late, I was going to say, which sounds, again, it's one of those comments maybe that's not appropriate, but
no,
yeah.
It's absolutely true, and it's something that's on my mind. I was talking to a comedian friend about this, again, like, because male comedians, I guess, you don't necessarily see the landscape the way that women do, and I started at 35, and at 35, I guess, technically, I've got a rich field of material that I can draw from. So I've lived a chaotic and ridiculous life, but there are a lot of people that can do what I do, that are like 22, 23, maybe, you know, they've got a lot longer to upskill, to be marketable.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like I'm on a bit of a clock now, where a lot of the people that are sort of big in their 40s as comedians, they've been on the circuit since their 20s. You know, they've done their time, they've paid their dues, they've been going for 10, 15 years. So it does feel like there's a countdown clock that is sort of chasing me down. So yeah, I put a lot of pressure on myself, I think, to try and hit some kind of form before I sort of, my shelf life is completely up, before I have to start actually lying about my age.
I feel exactly the same. Do you do that thing where you're like, people that you like, or even people that like maybe not aren't for you, but like they're well known and stuff, and you like go on their Wikipedia and check their age, and like, well, when did they, oh, they got that TV gig, oh shit, they're really young then, oh, but then they didn't do that till that age, and start sort of comparing ages with your journey.
And then people start talking about like Alan Rickman and like actors that have gone into things late in life, like, oh, they didn't even do it, like Olivia Colman used to be a cleaner and now look at her. It's like, yeah, but I'm not a character actor with a line into Peep Show, am I? I'm like a PR person that did a course to get over a fear of public speaking, and it escalated way beyond anything I expected. So slightly different scenarios, really. And I guess the PR job has been brill, because obviously I kind of know how to package things, and you've got a certain, I guess there's a certain polish to it, but that's a bit of a poison chalice as well, because I think there's some speculation that it's a lot of my sort of quite limited success, but it feels quite quick to, I guess, people outside, is hype based rather than talent. And I kind of agree. So I'm
really, really, I don't think so at all. I think if you're doing well, that you have to have something there that's working for you. I don't think you can, and you've been going a few years as well, I don't think you can keep that sustained through just hype. You know, you're not the Arctic Monkeys.
Not, so it'll be 3 years next week. I did my first ever gig, having accidentally done a 24-hour show with Mark Watson. I'm one of those people, it's weird, because you know, everybody knows someone who knows someone who had like a tweet that changed their life. It's one of those sort of urban legends, isn't it? It's like, oh, I tweeted my favorite pop star and now we're dating. It's that kind of vibe. But it's, so I tweeted that I'd done this stand-up comedy course to get over fear of public speaking. I was like, I'm not quite over it yet, but I'm sort of interested in maybe giving open micing a try. So I threw it out into the universe. So I tweeted about it once and I put one thing on Facebook. No one came back with anything useful. So I was like, well, I've done all I can, haven't I? That's it. That's all I can do. I put it out there. Nothing came back. I'll just put this idea to bed. And then Mark Watson saw my tweet and was doing a 26.2-hour show for charity to mimic a marathon. And he tweeted me back and said, do you want to learn stand-up comedy? and get over your fear of public speaking for charity with us at the Pleasance. Now, Mark Watson has been one of my favourite comedians for about, well, as long as I can remember comedy, really. I used to go and watch him at the Glee Club in Cardiff when I was about 19. So I had to say yes, even though it was like the scariest thing ever to consider getting up in front of people. Not even people, just like people that I really respected, because typically it's a proper tour de force of like really cool, famous and alternative comedy names in these shows. So I've watched them as an audience member, but I was like, nah, I've got to say yes to this, and I've got to make it work. And it was the start of something quite special for me. So, all because I tweeted, like, it happens. It's worth being on there. I know it's a cesspit, but sometimes, sometimes it comes good.
Well, that, because I think that idea of like, it's my wife and I do it at the end of every year. Well, actually, I haven't recently, but used to like sit in bed and say, like, what do you want to do next year? What do you want to achieve? And like say it out loud, that kind of thing. And there's a whole theory, isn't there, of like putting stuff into the ether and saying it will come back. And I think I sort of like 99% think that's probably bullshit. But yours is an example of it actually working. Like, genuinely, that's what you did. You sort of put it out there into the ether and it came back. So I guess there is some kind of truth behind it.
It's like, yeah, did I manifest it? Am I Noel Edmonds?
Yeah.
Did Noel Edmonds invent manifesting then?
I think he might have drawn light to it. It was like, what is it? Like astral listing or some... It felt like hokum when I read it.
What happened to Noel Edmonds?
But he came up with that concept, didn't he? The boxes game.
Or Deal or No Deal.
Deal or No Deal.
Yeah. And then...
So that kind of brought him back into pop culture, didn't it?
Was that before or after the cosmic stuff?
I think he might have asked the universe for that. So I guess that's a proof point in itself.
I'd forgotten about the cosmic stuff completely. But yeah. Did he manifest Mr. Blobby? Did that become some sort of like weird fever dream?
Oh, I hope so.
Maybe,
yeah. I something happened to him to come up with Mr. Blobby, so we can rule it out.
I'm not sure
where I saw this conversation going, but yeah.
I'm not sure we can give Noel so much credit for all these wonderful inventions like Mr. Blobby and Deal or No Deal. I mean, we'll give him manifesting, but the other ones I'm not sure about.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm on his Wikipedia page. I'll be
honest. In points. Yeah.
My Wikipedia tabs are brilliant already. I've got Yeti mic open. I've been looking at Buttons red coats on eBay to see how much they're worth. And there's none there, actually. So
you can't buy a red coat.
No, you can buy bears. You can buy signature books. People that have had their signature books and Butlin signed for £60. But I think they're really, really old. With no particular famous names. Bill Tennick. Charlie Martin. Are these well-known performers? I'm really showing my age now. I don't know. And then bears. Well, like all sort of like creepy old bears that are wearing red coats for £10. So it's not looking good.
Creepy old bears. Bears, not bears from the Happy Mondays.
Yeah, I was thinking you were saying bears as well.
I thought you said bears. And I was like, creepy old bears. So I was like, what do we call it, creepy?
No. If you could buy a toy of bears in a red coat off eBay, I mean, I'd be all over that.
People would definitely buy that. Let's make that a thing.
Bears. I think it'd be...
I was like, what would his talent have been as a red coat? What would he do?
Well, clearly dancing.
Dancing is enthusiastic, but it's not... It's not the work of a qualified man, is it? I don't think he's had any
formal training. No, definitely not formal training.
Unless taking loads of drugs, which is formal training, maybe part of the journey.
Yeah, he manifested it, and thus it was so.
Going back to the public speaking thing, was that through work or something? Was that something that obviously it was a personal kind of, you wanted some personal growth in that area? But was it to do with work? Was it to be more dynamic in meetings? What was the sole purpose, I guess, to start with?
Because I was a show off child to the point where my parents were proud, but also I think embarrassed by me in that way that you are when you know you've got a little precocious brat tour de force of a person.
I have one.
So I used to put on my own shows when I was like 7 or 8, and I would like write the shows, I'd star in the shows, I'd do all the marketing material for the shows, I'd go flyering up and down my street and would bully, by virtue of being a small child, would bully the neighbours to come to these shows and pay the ticket price, because you can't say no to a 7-year-old, a pushy little 7-year-old.
You charged a ticket price.
Hello, Linwin, what are you doing? £3 for this
£3
show of the Ugly Duckling. Yes. I know, I charge that now for work in progress for like real.
Yeah.
This is just me with like paper, a dress made, a paper dress with feathers glued onto it, emoting. So this is the kind of stuff I used to do all the time. Like, I'd be brilliant on The Apprentice. I also did a raffle as part of that specific run. The Ugly Duckling run. I did a raffle where my mum gave me £5 to buy prizes, and the top prize, so I decided to take a cut of the money myself.
Nice.
So the top prize was a bag of Jelly Babies, and the second prize was some chewing gum, and the raffle tickets were £1.
Jesus.
Wow.
And just for the extra, little knob of a child, I drew my own ticket and won the prize. So
I've won the Jelly Babies and some chewing gum.
What a surprise!
I don't know how I got, because I did GCSE drama as well and like really enjoyed the practical. At some point, I don't remember anything particularly happening to me, so it wasn't like I did a full Judy Finnegan and like my bra fell out on national television or anything. I don't remember any particular moment where I lost confidence.
Yeah.
It kind of developed over time, and it went from, oh, I'm a bit nervous about this, to my eyelid would twitch, like I'd feel physically sick at the thought of even standing up in a meeting in front of like 8 people. And my job's a lot of presentation, so that is that was a little bit of a problem. Like, I get through it if I had to make a presentation, and usually people would be like, oh, that was really fun, because something would switch on in my brain. But what I couldn't tell them is what I'd said probably didn't correlate to what I had to say. Like, I didn't get through my points or refer to my slides at all. I just sort of went in some kind of like white noise space and just went there. And I started to get invited to conferences to speak because I was a woman working in tech. So I worked in affiliate marketing for a while. I worked in cars. So I was one of the few speakers on like mobile phones. So from a press point of view, I was like quite a leading female speaker on things that are typically male dominated. And obviously the good thing is there's a lot more push to try and balance out panels. So now in a panel of 5 straight white men, they will put one lady. And
I feel progress sales.
Yeah, I feel really great about it. And they would ask, you know, they were asking me to be that lady, and I was saying no. And then I was going to these panel shows and seeing that there weren't any women on and going, oh, what if we're all saying no? We can't all say no. And then bitch about it together at the back of the room. I have to do something about this. So I signed up to do a half-day comedy course whilst I was drunk on New Year. I was like, it was like stand up for like basically for business. So it's like, for any aspect of your life. So if you wanted to learn a bit about stand-up, or you just wanted to be a bit more confident, it was like a half-day session with a not-for-profit called Funny Women, run by Lynn Parker. Mm-hmm. And it was just quietly revolutionary. It was really weird. It just flicked a switch in my mind. Like, it didn't switch anything off. But a lot of it felt like common sense. But sometimes you just need somebody else to say it back to you for it to stick. So I came out of that feeling like it was something that I could overcome.
Yeah.
What were some of the exercises? Oh, sorry, Jim. I was going to say, I was interested to know what some of the exercises were in that course.
My favorite one. So we all went around, you know, the classic, go around in a circle and tell us something that you wouldn't know about you just by looking at you. So there are probably about 25 of us in the room. And the specifics of it was, don't think about it. Like, you just say what comes up in your mind. Don't prepare it. Don't think about it. When it comes to you, just say something. And so we all went around in the circle and we said things. And then the next section of that task was, right, now we're going to go through this again, and you have to pretend you're the person that went before you, and you have to tell me everything you can remember about what they said. And obviously, none of us knew, because we were all so focused and obsessed on what we were going to say that no one had listened to a bloody word anybody else had said. So it was like, I think her name's Sarah. And the point was made, it was about active listening, and basically you wouldn't be able to get yourself into the lather that we'd all got ourselves into, stressing out about what we had to say, if we were actually present in the room, listening to other people, riffing off them, like life would be a lot easier. And that was the first time I'd ever really thought about that. And I was like, God, how much have I missed going to these meetings, going to these conferences, just looking at my paper, getting myself in a proper little stress. Like, I've missed quite a lot, and I'm better in meetings for it now because I do actually pay attention. But don't tell my bosses, I'm always paying attention.
We'll cut that bit. We'll cut it. It's fine.
Leave it in. I don't care.
There is a sort of liberation, isn't there, to also just saying the first thing that comes to your mind as well. Yeah. and not having to overly prepare. And I'm bad at that at gigs, actually, of like looking at my notes and stuff. And actually, sometimes you go on stage and it's more freeing if you just sort of chat to the audience or talk or see what comes to your mind and stuff. But there
is definitely... prep for that, though, I guess. Like, you have to start with
your
scripted bit so you know that you can get back on track. So there's a mixture of both. Like, you've got to know your material. Sometimes you see people go out and just completely wing it and you're like,
some people that can. There are some, I mean, there's a few comedians on the circuit that really can and just like brilliant at that.
I've heard that about Michael McIntyre, actually, because Michael McIntyre, I think he's much derided as a comedian, because partly because we're all a bit jealous that he's been so successful. But people ask me what my ambition in comedy is, and it's a basic one. I want at least one thing that people can go away and maybe in like 6 months' time, they'll look at something differently and go, that's what that comedian said. And I think Michael McIntyre does that on such a brilliant level, where I find myself quoting him to people or in my own heads, just like, I can't see like a parasol on holiday without thinking about like his little bit about it, or someone overtaking you on the motorway. And I know it's like, oh yeah, everyone can say it's just observation, everybody can say what they've seen, but I just think there's such a beautiful skill in the simplicity of it, in making people think that you're talking to them. It's something Sean Walsh does really well as well. Yeah. You can feel like, I used to think his sets were like written for me. I was like, oh my God, how does he know? How does he know I do that? And it's like, it's so special. And that's the kind of vibe I want. I want people to feel like I'm connecting with them, even if we're in a room of like 400. So.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Mark McIntyre. I think it's horrible that there's negativity about being likable. Like, he's a likable person.
An element of that. And I guess maybe if people are having green room experiences that don't.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
From what I've heard, someone told me that they saw him. They were a bit skeptical about him because he was just coming up as a comedian. Mm. His name was being bandied about. And they saw him come and do a gig where he improvised the whole thing and people were hysterical. Like, he did like 10 minutes on someone at the front's hat. And, you know, it's that kind of skill. And so everybody, I think, who's worked with him at club level isn't surprised. Mm. But I guess it's easy to see. It felt overnight, even though it probably wasn't overnight. Yeah, there was a lot of work. There's a lot of natural skill because there's some stuff you can't teach, but a lot of work would have gone into that as well.
Yeah, because I think I'm going back to him. I think I saw him on some Raw Variety thing, which was like, I don't know, in the mid noughties. So it's been, you know, I think it has taken him a while. But yeah, I guess because he become a kind of, I guess, that early evening kind of entertainment thing, it does get sort of, like you say, derided slightly, which is a bit unfair, I think.
It's not always true. I don't love all the sort of crowd pleasers. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to get in trouble. But yeah, it's not always true. But I think he's got a real warmth about him as well. Genuinely, I used to watch his clips on YouTube. Like, they were the kind, I could watch like hours of it. And it was the kind of clips like I'd send to people. I'd go, oh, Dad, this is you. And I think I love that. And I think I'm kind of pitched because it's weird because I'm a massive alternative comedy fan. Like, I love alternative comedy more than life, but it's not who I am and it's not how I write. And that will never not be a disappointment to me because it's like Andrew Neil's one of my favorite comedians. I went to their show and they genuinely they articulated things like, that are quite dry topics, things like veganism and sustainability, in a way that genuinely has changed my behaviors. Like, how? Like, it was hilariously funny, but there's a thing about how many mugs you've got in your cupboard. And every time I open my cupboard, I'm like, fuck, that's a lot of mugs. I don't need these mugs. I have got a favorite mug. What? Like, I just wish I had that kind of skill to present something in a kind of a weird and alternative way. And it's, but I'm kind of knowingly a bit middle of the road. And I think this is sort of one of my insecurities, I guess, as a comedian. I was saying this to a friend. I don't know if I'll ever be anybody's favorite on a bill. And I think I have to come to terms with that.
That's a big leap to make. You don't know that. You don't know who's in the audience. You don't know
I'm never my favourite. You'll watch people absolutely smash and you'll be like, because there's a new comedian, relatively new, called Dan Tiernan, and he's just been nominated for Best Newcomer at the Chortle Awards. And I remember the first time I saw him and I went away like giddy from seeing him because it was such a high octane set. It was so well written. It was so unusual that I was excited on his behalf. I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to see what happens next to this guy. And he's just gone from strength to strength. And like, God, it'd be lovely to be someone who had that. And I don't think
I mean, I think all comedians have that. We all sort of like play ourselves down a bit. But I think you don't know who's gone away from gigs you've been at that where your material has just been at the right time, right moment, right pitch for them at that moment. And they went away thinking, oh, that's exactly how I feel about stuff. Or I had similar experiences. And I think, and they might not tell you about it. You know, we all go on Twitter after gigs and like see if anyone's tweeted or stuff, whatever. But like,
Come on.
Okay. Well, I've done 5 gigs this week. Okay, cool. Well, that's depressing.
It's the only woman on the bill. At least tell me I was rubbish and women aren't funny. Exactly. Recognize.
Give me something. Give me something. But you don't know. You just, you know, you just don't know who's in the audience or who's there. And yeah, I'm sure there are people that have come away from all comedians' gigs and connected to something and gone away and thought about it or quoted it the next day or texted a mate or something.
So wouldn't you? And I think that is the beauty, like I said, like the representation is getting slightly better for women. It's still absolutely extraordinary how many all male lineups are just being tabled over and over again. And I know that good female comedians are out there. We're out there. We meet each other occasionally when there's two women on the bill, and I know there is an active effort to try. But the responsibility on that at a big gig when you are the only woman on the bill, it's just like you don't want to people to walk away and go, well, it's like I thought women aren't funny. So you feel like you carry the weight of all women on bills like that. And it's a strange one.
Especially when a lot of the bills have, I've got to be careful here, but like quite mediocre performing white blokes, I'm probably one of them.
You know, there's a lot of, there's a market for that style of comedian, because I did a big club gig recently and the feedback was like, yeah, we'll see you again in a year maybe, because my joke count isn't very high. And that's the thing, because I'm a storyteller, and that suits gigs where people like are proper comedy fans, and that is a style that they love. And like when you're on a bill with someone like Mark Watson, who's quite long form, for example, you know, the people that love that, and they'll come with you.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if the laugh is like 40 seconds in, but with those big club gigs where it might be people who are out on a stag night, people who are just having a night out, but they're not really comedy fans and they only ever watch like Kevin Bishop. Yeah. And they just want that. They want that stuff. It's the classic stuff. And you hear people laughing about things. It's like, are we still laughing about that? Are we still making fun of fat people? Are we? Is that a thing we're still doing? But you see the audience response to it and you go, I guess it works. I would never do it, but I see the market is there. If people want to speak to that market, it's not for me. But I think club comedy is quite an interesting one for that. And I think there's a lot more nuance to women's material. And again, there's that vibe that if you're talking about women's things, they're not general appeal. Like the notion that men can't just sit through maybe one joke about periods and it's not for them and it's ruined their night, which I don't think is true.
No.
But I did a poll because my friend is runs a research agency, and I did a poll in lockdown to see who thought women were funny and who didn't. And the data came out that most men would say male comedians were the funniest, but also a lot of women agreed. So they'd say the funniest person in their life was like their dad, and like no one's putting their female friends at the top of the list. And when you see, you know, I don't want to be an apologist for how TV shows and panel shows are booked, when you see data like that, because a lot of them are data led because they want the most views possible for the advertising revenue. When you see data like that, where both men and women say they'd rather see men, it's a predicament, isn't it? So I think we just need to be a bit more open to, like, everybody can be funny, and all start putting our money where our mouths are. And if you see female comedy nights, all female lineups where it's heralded, female lineups, a lot of the times it's mainly women in the audience. The same with like women in business conferences. It's not a comedy thing. Conference that's mainly women will attract mainly female delegates. And the people that are there, we already know.
Exactly.
No one is learning anything in that room that like about the universality and like what resonates with men, women, and non-gender conforming people, like, we're already bought in. So if you're a woman audience member at an all-female comedy night, you're the person that doesn't learn anything. She's like, yeah, I already knew this, women. Great.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's a problem that, because obviously I work in marketing and PR as well, it's an interesting problem to solve. And I don't know who's responsible for solving it, because it feels like it's going to require quite a seismic shift in public sentiment. Because nobody wants to put on a gig like, oh, it's an all-female lineup. Nobody wants to put on a gig and then have it half full. So that's not fun for the lineup. That's not good for revenue. So I don't know where the changes need to be for this to be better.
So does it takes like, if there's an all-female lineup, it takes like blokes who would normally go and see something else saying, right, tonight we're going to go and see this all-female lineup and like tell their mates about it and tweet about it and stuff. And so there's a bit more, I guess, noise around it. And then...
Yeah. And it's like, it's okay.
Other blokes might see that.
It's okay to go to this. We're not just going to talk about periods. That, you know, we also like the same stuff, guys.
But also, what if you do?
You'll be all right because we're going to explain it to you. We will contextualize the thing.
Exactly. And like, it'll be funny.
We'll all learn something about each other, and it will be funny. Yeah.
And funny is funny. Like, it doesn't. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. The bottom line is funny is funny, and yeah. I don't. Yeah, that is really interesting about the data driven stuff. And you're completely right, and I can see why now. TV bookers book the way they do and stuff like that, and even promoters with club gigs and stuff. But
yeah, it's just you know, because there's a lot of hack stuff about like women, how emotional women are. It's like, it's not, and this is why I love podcasts like yours, like, it's not okay for men to be emotional. It's like, without someone going, ooh, are you on your period? Yeah. It's like, no, I'm not angry with you because I'm on my period. That might be why I've just told you to your face, but the fact remains, you're an asshole. It's not why. We all have hormones. It's not just, that's not exclusive to women, but it's just
And see that guy who's like having a fight down the pub car park. He's emotional, by the way. That's why he's
playing out in a slightly different way, but ultimately he's not all right. Ask if he's okay. It's just really interesting. Like, that's why I love Rich Wilson's podcast as well, Insane the Membrane, because it's nice to hear those topics discussed. Yeah. And it's nice to have male comedians who talk about that, who bring the topics to the stage as well and sort of highlight these things. And we do need that, I think. I think we do. It's sad, but we do need, men to get behind and validate these female comedians, these non-binary comedians. These are worth your time. Make the time to go and see them. And you see people doing good work in it, but... You know, to get to equality, I think you do have to over-index for a little bit until it becomes equal. And that's the thing. You'll hear that argument when you're like, oh, well, this isn't fixing it. An all-female lineup. Well, that's excluding men, isn't it? It's like, no. Oh, yeah. Sometimes you need to over-correct.
Yeah, absolutely.
To hit the middle, to come to the average. That's just the nature of it. And it's brilliant to see more disabled comedians getting spots on panels. And like, that's not a spot that they're taking from me. That is a spot they richly deserve. And I would love to see an all disabled lineup, just because I'm like, yeah, brilliant. They exist. There needs to be more accessibility. The reason we're not seeing more of them is people who are physically disabled. Open mic venues are not fit for that. Yeah. A lot of them are upstairs, downstairs. They're in basements. They're in attics. They're disabled people can't even come to a lot of comedy gigs. And that's something like Sophie Huggins doing a lot of good work on that, in trying to find venues that are accessible, that have gender neutral toilets. But these places don't always exist, but we need more people doing more of that, because you're not going to see these voices. We're not going to see more diverse acts if they're not getting booked and progressing, because there's one slot for them. So you're not going to see the rich variants of it. Same with women. It's same with anybody who comes from a more diverse background. Maybe we do need these gigs. We do need these like showcase gigs, because how do you progress? Because it's graft. It's so competitive. You could kind of make your own open mic circuit. If you're just a normal like white middle-class person, you can rattle around the open mic circuit and you'll be busy every night. You might not be successful, but you'll be busy every night if you are like the median person, human being in Britain. But it's so much harder for everybody else. It's weird. It's weird and competitive, and it's a strange thing to come into as an adult, I think, somebody who's like 35, like, see this, because sometimes it feels like you're in a big sixth form.
Yeah. Has it been a bit of a baptism of fire to a certain extent?
I've never known such a supportive community, though, I've got to say. Like, and the ladder comes down, like, at every opportunity. I don't think I've ever approached any, like, proper established comedian, asked for something reasonable, and they've not come back and replied or offered advice, but in the spirit of, I don't know if I'm telling you something you already know. It's never patronizing. So I think the ladder is thrown down more regularly in comedy than I've seen in any other sector. So obviously I've worked in quite male dominated sectors, so automotive, finance, tech. It's been really refreshing and inspirational, and yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting then when you see these people break through, the nice people that have been kind to you. You see them start to rise. Like Esther Manito is a good example of that. She's absolutely brilliant. And she's going from strength to strength. She's on Live with Apollo. And it was just so exciting to see, you know, some people who just work hard and deserve it actually get the recognition. It gives you a bit of hope. So
yeah. Well, it's nice. It's nice to see nice people doing well. Like that's just a nice feeling. But
and people do get behind it in comedy in a way that, again, you don't necessarily see in other industries. So Pope Lonergan's book is coming out and people are like really pushing. They're like, this is a brilliant book. You should read it. Everyone's just really proud. They're proud that the book exists. They're proud of him because he's a great guy. He's really funny and he deserves it. And you see that a lot. You see a lot of people lifting each other up. And it's quite special, I think.
I started comedy, I did worry that maybe it was an industry full of just like narcissists and like, you know, not nice people. And the mentally ill. Again, of which I am one.
Same.
But actually, no, I've met some amazing people. Well, I met my wife through comedy because we did the same comedy course back in the day. So that was...
Which comedy course? That's awesome.
We did Logan Murray's Amuse Moves.
I've done that one.
Yeah, the Black Heart in Camden, which weirdly I was near on Wednesday, so I took a little photo from around. I was like, remember this place? Not a romantic venue, to be fair, at all, but was the first place we met. It's too trendy, just too trendy. I have met some brilliant people through comedy, and there are lots of nice people. I think comedy probably attracts mostly sort of, am I going to get political here?
Yeah.
Sort of lefty leaning emotional sort of people, I guess, which is my people. And I think people that go into comedy, I think, do see the good in people, I think, and want... It's a weird one because you want people to succeed because you want it to create a supportive, nice industry, but you also want yourself to succeed as well. So you hope that's what comes back as well. And I think it does if you put kindness out there, then I think it does come back. But yeah, I just remember back in the day when I first started, slightly nervous about it, but it was pleasingly surprising actually that there are a lot of nice people in that industry.
Well, I guess everyone
shouldn't be a surprise.
Yeah, well, it's quite a vulnerable thing to do, isn't it? You're putting yourself on stage and expressing yourself, and it could be personal things you're talking about as well a lot of times. So it's a very vulnerable thing to go and put yourself up for.
It is. You are testing how much people like you. Effectively, and some people hide behind a bit more of a character, but ultimately, you know, you can't not take it personally on a bad night where you feel like you've done all you can, even though, you know, it goes into the heads of people that you can't control. Maybe they've had a bad day, maybe something has resonated really badly. You never know what kind of cauldron you're walking into. So it's a high stakes game. As someone who is as anxious as I am and as people pleasing as I am astonished that this is what I choose to do in my life.
Same. And I would say numerous times a week, or depending on how many times I'm gigging, I'm sat there thinking, why the fuck am I doing this to myself?
Yeah.
Why am I here?
I choose to do this. Yeah. I choose to do this. I hosted a stag party show on the weekend. And as a 37-year-old woman, you do not envision a scenario where you are having to say to a man that you've just met, who's also in their 30s, please do not shit in that bin.
Oh God.
It's like, again, I traveled for like 3 hours to get there, and I was like, I've chosen this.
It's not Bognor,
I choose to be here. I could walk away, I could get up at any time and go, this isn't for me. They do not value my professionalism. Why am I still doing this? But I battled through it because I don't know what it is.
Yeah, because like,
you just get through it. It's like, well, we're here now. I guess we'll make it work. But yeah. That was a weird day. A weird hour of my life.
Yeah, that is.
And I was
weird
with
thing.
Another comedian as well, a male comedian. And these stags not only were, well, they're exactly, think of a stereotypical stag party. it was them. But alongside the, you know, the calls of getting your cock out, there was also, they started to ship me and this other comedian. And so interspersed with the cocks out, cocks out, it was like, kisser, kisser, kisser. I just, like, I guess they need to express themselves some way. But what a weirdly wholesome heckle. Like, they're like, these guys are clearly getting on. You should give her a kiss. Just give her a kiss on the cheek. Like, as we left, that was what they said. They're like, just give her a little kiss now for us. It's like, why? Why do you want that? What's wrong with you?
The male psyche is an absolute fucking mess, isn't it?
It really is. It was so weird. I was like, what can you possibly get from that? But they were really bought into the idea of me and this male comedian, like, getting together. So
maybe they just, like, grew up on Blind Date and they just loved the idea of pairing people off.
Is that what they thought the concept of the show was? Who knows?
Maybe, like, an added bonus at the end of the show. Yeah. We had a good time and we've match made as well. What a lovely evening.
Like, in their minds, they were forging an unbreakable bond between us through trauma.
Yeah.
There's a book in this. I think one of us should write a book about this.
Stag do's are the biggest nightmare, aren't they?
They're horrible to be on as well. Oh, like, as a non-drinker,
no one liked it. No one was enjoying it. There was this one guy, Jay, who was he drank like 5 pints in my company. I was only with him for an hour, and he was weeping into the last one. He didn't want it, and I was death. The more I tried to defend Jay against the pint that he was challenged to drink, the more they wanted him to drink it. Obviously, so I couldn't help him. There was nothing I could do for him. But I was like, he looked at me, and he looked so sad.
Yes. Save me now, or kill me.
I don't know how to help you, Jay. I'm really sorry. It's just like, under what circumstance, other circumstance, would you do that? Like, it's genuinely,
it's abuse.
It's feral. And, like, yeah. I don't think any of them are those people day to day life. By virtue of the fact that the king stag was obviously marrying she looked like a nice woman. Possibly conduct himself like that. In polite company.
The woman, the bride.
No, but I heard really nice stuff about her from the other stags. Like what makes men get together and become the worst version of themselves?
The last stag night I went on, because I don't drink, so I'm teetotal.
Oh, God.
It was just, they'd booked a medieval banquet. Which made it even worse, because they were just like, they were just being so horrible to the staff and everything. It was just gross.
And that was another thing that I hated. They were shouting at the lady landlady. Yeah. They were just like screaming at her, and they thought they were being funny and like we're in some kind of carry-on situation. But I was like, this woman is just at work.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
She did not need this today. Technically, so was I, but I feel like I had a slightly bigger insight into how my night was going to go than poor old Jane did.
Yeah. I ended up going, and because the waitress that was dealing with our table, I just went and apologised and said, I'm so sorry for these people.
Did they pick medieval? Because I felt like they could then, like, there was no excuse for barbaric.
It was so horrible because they did end up having a food fight.
For fuck's sake.
Yeah, it was just, you know, and I was just quite happy to just eat my meal. You know, I was just like, this is a lovely, lovely... lamb shank or whatever.
You're wrong there. You're supposed to throw it halfway across the venue. That's what it was there for. It wasn't there for eating, Giles. Come on.
Bless him. The groom, he's one of my best mates. He's lovely. And I think he was, you know, I think he was fairly embarrassed afterwards. But yeah, it was just some of his mates were just
There's also
horrendous.
That pressure. If you don't drink or choose not to drink or you're driving or whatever, then people start doing that. Why are you not drinking?
Yeah, oh, I got that.
Why
are
you not drinking? Go on, have a drink. Have a drink.
All night.
No, I don't want to drink for whatever reason. It's my reason.
Yeah.
That sort of
you
like
have to
weird...
explain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not, that's not nice either.
No, but funny old way.
I just think, just changing the subject slightly, we were obviously talking about opportunities and stuff, and I was thinking podcasts, and I remember when we had Deborah Frances White on, and we were talking about obviously The Guilty Feminist and how popular that's been, and saying that there is obviously a massive appetite for female comedy out there, you know, huge download numbers and stuff. And obviously, you've got your podcast, and there's an opportunity for you to have up and coming
people listen to that. Yeah. Literally, tens.
They do. They no hundreds. I love your podcast, but I'm just I'm saying no. But it's an opportunity.
Really it. It's, no. If it was tens, I wouldn't bother. I'm somebody who like fails fast, and you know, it's like learn quickly. I'm fail fast. I'm like, well, fuck this. Again, which is how I don't understand how comedy was the thing that stuck. Because I've done hobbies. I've tried hobbies. Mm, roller derby, like the gym, running, things that were genuinely good for me. And what I've chosen to pursue at great expense and psychological cost is like the most ridiculously unstable pursuit in the world. Yeah. But I love it. It's like a true love. Like genuinely, on Valentine's Day, I tweeted about comedy. I was like, everything about it is me. I'm in love with this. Like,
I think you're right. It is a love, because I wonder that as well. I'm just someone that genuinely enjoys quitting things. And I don't know if it's just like...
Oh, same. It's liberating.
It's liberating. It's like a power grab. Like, I've decided to quit this. Fuck you. I'm in charge kind of thing.
You should see my CV. Get on LinkedIn. Yeah, I am very much...
I used to like get jobs just so I could quit like 6 weeks later, just for like the power of just like, yeah, taking it back.
I think it's really important though. And I think it's really important to be able to quit things, because that's sort of not in the DNA. Because I guess we're a similar bracket of life in that our parents were like jobs for life people. And to quit would be a weakness. And they had a work ethic. It was like, even if you're not feeling very well, you go into work and you do your best. And like quitting a job within a year was deemed quite flaky. Like my parents have hated every time I'm like, oh, this is not for me. They're not respecting my boundaries. We move on. Genuinely, like I've been advised against it at every single point I've wanted to leave a job where I'm like psychologically like crawling.
Just
because it's like, oh, you might not be able to get another job. But I guess that is something that modern workplace, you don't. There are enough jobs. Like digital has created millions of jobs that didn't exist before because the internet didn't exist. So. Yeah. There's always something else. And I guess I'm quite difficult to have in a business that relies on that work ethic, because I'm very, because of comedy. And I think this is another thing that massively changed my life and why comedy was the one that stuck. I was like, my job was all consuming because I made it that. I made it. It was my personality. It was the people that I worked with, the people that I socialized with were by virtue of proximity, the people that I worked with and other people in PR. And like, I was checking emails first thing in the morning. I was checking emails on holiday. Mm-hmm. And none of the places I've worked required that. Like, I didn't work in government. I worked at like cashback sites. Like, if that cashback deal did not go to the Sun newspaper, no one was going to die. But in my head, the anxiety of it. And it was just all consuming. It took up my whole headspace. And having somewhere else to go that I wanted to go to made me manage my time differently. I was leaving on time. I was saying no to going to drinks with people at work who I didn't care about. Like, I didn't not like them or hate them, but I wasn't that bothered about going to the pub with them. But I'd allow myself to sort of float along, and maybe I'd spend £30 having drinks with people that I had an ambient connection with. I wasn't enjoying. And now I'm like, well, I've got a gig at 7:30, so I've got to go. And when I get to the gig, I can't be checking my emails. I get to be someone different, and I'm associating with different people. So if I am checking my emails, people think I'm crazy. They're like, does the work pay you for this? I'm like, no, but it's... And like, it's been really refreshing. Like, it's completely broken a lot of what I thought was going to be my life. I thought I was kind of locked onto this path that I was quite happy with. I built it myself. I'd done 15 years in PR. I was like, this is for me. I'll slowly get more and more responsibility, slightly more money. My holidays will be slightly better because I'll earn slightly more money. And this came and just petrol bombed everything, really.
So
in the best way. I don't know. Yeah. I would have told you when I was doing my jobs before that I would not have time to like do an evening class. And now I'm doing, I can do like 4 nights a week.
Yeah.
And my full-time job. And you do find the time. And I hate tropes. You know, it's like, oh, do something you love and you'll find the time. But it is true. That's so annoying. So annoying, isn't it? But people are like, how do you find the time? It's like, because I can't imagine not finding the time because I love this. This is what I want to get up in the morning and do. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
But you're right about sort of like, once you go to a gig and stuff, you have to be present. So you can't then, and if everything else work-wise or whatever, anything else that you should or shouldn't be looking at does drop by the wayside, because you have to be there in the moment and ready to your set. And
no one dies. And no one has died anytime I've done that. Every time I did that and nothing bad happened, there were no consequences to me putting my phone in my bag, putting it you know, in the loosely termed green room, which
which is again some store cupboard or something.
I built new pathways in my brain where I just thought, and I started going, okay, is this reasonable? Do I need to do this now? Can I do it tomorrow? And it just, I started managing my time in a different way. And then I built up a lot, you know, I've built healthier boundaries with work.
Yeah.
And that's something that I then try and pass on to like junior members of staff. And that's not always, that's not always what businesses want or need, is it?
I think they probably do need it. I think we don't want it, but I think they do. And I was going to say the word boundaries as well. So exactly what it sounds like, you've created healthy boundaries, which I think anybody in any industry outside of, I guess, the emergency services can probably benefit from.
Yeah, so it was an interesting learning, like quite later in life, and I'm glad that I learned it, but now I'm an evangelist for it. So if a friend's saying, oh, it's 9 o'clock and I'm still working, I'm like, why?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are they paying you for that? How many hours have you done this week? They stop paying you Wednesday afternoon.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cut it loose.
Yeah.
Have the conversation, I guess. Yeah. The beauty of working in like younger, cooler companies like my current company is they are happy to have that conversation. They know it, they anticipate it, and it makes me feel optimistic for the next sort of generation of people going into high pressure jobs, in that hopefully they will make time for themselves before they sort of come to a breakdown point, which I did a few years ago when I went freelance, and it took me about 6 months to even start digging myself out of that because I just burnt myself out with it.
What were you doing? You're just doing loads and loads of hours, was that?
Well, I left a job. I was invited to leave a job, we'll say.
I've been invited to leave lots of jobs.
I accepted the invitation. In poor grace, but I accepted the invitation. And I went freelance because everybody sells this dream, this notion that freelancing, working for yourself, is like all pictures of people with their laptops on the beach. But for me, the stress of that, not knowing where my, you know, not knowing that in 6 months' time I will definitely be paid, not being paid for illness, not being paid for holiday, the intensity of that anxiety like completely bowled over any sense of joy that I work for myself. I was treating contracting work like I couldn't see it on a monthly basis like I would with a salary job, because I was being paid a day rate. I felt like I had achieved something every day. And the stress of that was insane. I just get to the end of the day and you could coast, you know, because some days you're really productive, some days you coast. And I never felt like I could coast. I always felt like I had to be like the best version of myself. And yeah, it was, but when I said at the end, because I was like a shell, I was haggard with it. When I said at the end that I was going to stop freelancing and go back into a workplace, people spoke to me like I like failed or like I'd misunderstood it. And a lot of people were trying to sell it back to me like, no, the first 6 months is always hard. It's about to get really good. But to our point earlier, Jim, like, I'm not going to wait another 6 months for it to get good. I don't know how many days I've got left in my life. No one does. So that just felt like too high a price to pay. But I had lost a lot of confidence, again, because I was holding myself to really high standards every day. And when I wasn't achieving anything, I was going home and giving myself an absolute kicking for it mentally. And then I was drinking quite heavily because I couldn't switch off. Because I was worried about 3 months' time, 6 months' time, a year's time, tax, things that I hadn't anticipated, like all these extra things. So then I was drinking a lot and obviously waking up not in a fit state to face a day, like even a normal day, let alone another high pressure day. And I started to use alcohol as a bit of a crutch. And reluctant to say it was like a huge problem because I did sort of dig myself out of it, but it felt like a dependency. Like that first drink of the night, just like, because I needed to like be bonked on the head to switch off really. That cumulatively, then waking up the next day, like not feeling very well, not feeling fit for the day, not being able to manage small tasks. Because when you're hungover, you're not, you know, even small things feel like, trees do feel like monsters. And so I was in a really sort of bad way by the time I sort of limped into a full-time job back in the service of the man.
But having that structure and stuff was...
I needed it. I didn't want to be my own HR person. I couldn't be... It wasn't for me. But genuinely, the vibe from other people was, it felt like a fail. And they're like, oh, if anyone was going to make it as a freelancer, we thought it would be you. It felt like a natural progression. I felt like I was failing them as much as I was failing myself, because I hate to disappoint people. So it took me longer to break out of that than it should have, because I kept letting people talk me into, no, it's about to get really good. It's not for everyone. I think we need to start having these conversations. Yeah. It's not the holy grail. Like, for some people, it's brilliant and they're the right type of person, but I'm quite happy to someone else do the maths. Just you pay me at the end of the month.
Yeah, my wife's exactly the same. She's a teacher. She likes that structure of going to work and having that set hours and time. And, you know, she's exactly the same. And we've talked about it before. She's said she'd find it very difficult to work from home, you know, just because it isn't unstructured, and she'd just be constantly like looking for other things to like spend her hours doing and stuff. Yeah, it's just really hard.
And I guess comedy's freelancing in a way, but you can do as much or as little as you want. And because I do have the day job, I think it never feels too pressurized. Like, some days I'll have a really busy day and I'll be like, right, I'm gonna make a spreadsheet, and then I'll never look at it again. Yeah.
It's something that's come up with a few guests recently, actually, who have got other jobs. And I think it's actually quite, for all of them, they've said it's really nice to have that other thing. So then, one, they're not so reliant on, you know, desperately trying to make money from the thing, you know, their thing that they love. But, you know, just having that bit of structure as well is really important to them. So, yeah, I think it's good. I mean, I'm sure Jim and I do regular work as well. I mean,
I'm applying for full-time jobs literally right now.
What are you going to do?
Well, I haven't actually got a reply from any of them. So currently I'm going to do literally nothing because no one's replying.
Tweeting about it once. I understand that is the most you can do.
I'll just tweet Mark Watson. He'll sort me out, I'm sure.
Find Jim a job.
He just finds a way to sort
everyone out. Honestly, the man is a fixer. Like, he's another one that I just like, I recognize a lot of myself in his traits, in that he's always got 10 projects on the go at once. And that is so me. It's just like, oh, I'm really busy. Yes, I would like to do a radio show. Yes.
But I think it sounded like the people that were talking to you about freelance and stuff like it sounded like that was their dream.
I think maybe they wanted to believe that was because
they wanted to do it, maybe, and they
sort of projecting a little bit on you,
or whatever.
Or they're freelancing and they're having a really hard time. They have to believe it's better.
It's not as everyone's path is different. Everyone's life is different, and that's just the way it goes. There is no one set thing for all of us. Also, you don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what's going to happen in the future, work-wise and stuff. We might all have to be freelance at one point. We might all have to be full-time. We don't know what's going to happen there. But I think it's a braver thing to go. You said earlier about quitting. You try something, it's not working, to go, do you know what? This isn't working for me. I'm going to go back to this, or I'm going to do something else. So that is a...
There's absolutely no shame in that.
And carrying on something where it's making you ill, and it was making you ill. And I think that's you practice self-care in that moment.
Too late, though. Too late. Because the worst thing was, it was, again, this is when you put other people before you, and I've learned the lesson. Well, it's a lesson that I can't learn. The universe keeps trying to teach me it. So I was at a job and I was having a brilliant time and I was loving it and I felt really rewarded by it, but I felt like I needed another extra person on my team to manage the amount of work that I was doing. And I became quite diva-ish about it. And I thought the best thing I can do here, and, you know, again, this was like reading bad advice on the internet, was find another job and then come back and negotiate. Because I'm prepared to walk away, they're not going to take my demands seriously. So I found another job that I was prepared to do, but I really didn't. Could have taken it or left it. And handed in my notice in. It was accepted. Balls. My boss didn't believe me, because I think my boss had a real insight into what I was like. We worked quite closely together and we were quite similar people. So we kind of played this long game, effectively, where 2 weeks before I was due to leave, and it was like a 3-month notice period, 2 weeks before I was due to leave, he messaged me on Slack and was like, okay, fine. Have what you want. We're in a standoff. He's like, you can have what you want. Let's sit down about it tomorrow. And I was so worried that this job that I was going to had waited 10 weeks for me.
Yeah.
I walked away from a job that I absolutely loved when I got given exactly what I wanted, because out of politeness, because I could not envision telling a stranger effectively that I didn't know that I didn't want to work there. I just, the idea of that made me want to like skin myself. So the most sensible thing for me in my mind, whatever was going on up there, was to walk away from the job that I loved with the colleagues that I loved and a sense of satisfaction and everything that I asked for, and go to a job that I never expected to have to do. And as you can imagine, that did not go well. So yeah, that was the job that I was invited to leave from. And the irony was, I was going to extend my probation there because I was like, this isn't for me. And it was making me ill. It wasn't a job that I wanted to do, but the weight of the expectation on it, I wanted to do it because they wanted me to do it, and I wanted to please them. So yeah, I literally left the job that I loved out of politeness, and I still wonder about that decision. Like, that is one of those forks in the road.
Yeah.
I think will haunt me forever. Like, what would have happened had I not done that? Like, that whole chain of events, like looking for another job, could I be more of an adult about it and like given my view a bit more grown, in a bit more of a grown up manner? Like, as you can imagine, I've done a post-mortem of this for like the last 5 or 6 years.
Well, I guess like these moments give you a chance to reflect, don't they? Like, even if it doesn't go the way, looking back, like you think it should have done, like it gives you a moment to reflect and ask yourself questions and maybe treat things differently in the future if you have a similar sort of thing. But I completely understand the idea of like not letting those new people down. I think I probably would have done the same. And as you said earlier, if you had turned down that job, no one would have died. Like, it would have been,
they would have found someone else on the next list or something.
Yeah.
But I guess, yeah, I'm quite, when I'm at my most mentally balanced, I'm pretty pragmatic about it, because every small decision led to where I am now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I might not have done comedy, and like that has unlocked something that I didn't know I could ever be part of. And it's still exhilarating to be doing it. Still, every now and again, I'll catch myself, because if I told 3 years and 2 months ago me that this is where I'd be doing this, I wouldn't have believed it. I would have backed a lottery win over that. Like, I genuinely thought it was completely. And, you know, I guess that's, I love saying this to people, because it's, like I said, I thought, look, I was locked onto this path. I was doing well in a career that I liked. You just don't know what will happen next if you say yes to things that are a bit scary, but you feel a bit excited by. So anyone who says they want to do stand-up, or like, oh, I thought about doing it, I'm like, give it a go. Answer the question. Yeah. Answer it now. Don't answer it when you're 35. Give yourself a bigger window. but yeah, I've been so surprised by life. And like, I wouldn't have traded any of those decisions, as hard as they were, to not end up here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So... but yes, that's not always true. Like I said, at my most mentally balanced, that's true. But at 3 a.m. when I haven't slept for 4 nights and I'm like absolutely alive with anxiety, less pragmatic. Mm.
Yeah, and that time you really need to sleep, but your brain is working through the 100 things.
Remember when you sent that Valentine's card to that guy you worked in Tesco's with, and you thought you were being really mysterious, but you'd faintly written your name in pencil? Like, yeah, I do. Thanks. Paul Welsh, his name was. Wonder what he's doing now. I can say that now because I'm actually doing, you know, you can Google me. I'm doing all right.
Yeah, so exactly.
I want to believe that Paul Welsh is wondering what Vic Slayton's doing now.
Yeah, he is.
Who knew what would have happened if he'd responded to that Valentine's card in the way that my 17-year-old heart hoped he would?
Oh, Vix, it's been such a lovely conversation with you. Thank you so much for your time today.
I'm such a huge fan of you both. This has been a proper dream come true.
To have you on. It's a real privilege. And I'm glad we've been able to sort it out, because I know we've been talking about it for ages. These things sometimes take time. But yeah, thank you so much for giving us your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There you have it, Vic Slayton on The Blank Podcast. Brilliant guest. I would say, Giles, quite inspirational, really, in terms of the decisions she's made with going into comedy and how it's, you know, she was telling us about the times when she was really sort of struggling with work and stuff. And then she's made these bold decisions to sort of change her life. And she's ended up in this really supportive industry and is doing something she loves. So I think that really that's a lesson for all of us, really, that if you feel like there's something you want to do or need to do, you do it and see where it takes you. And you know, she is a good example of the benefits you can get from that. So, yeah, really up our street in terms of Blank Podcast themes. Absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I love Vic. She's so great to talk to. And yeah, I can see her career going upwards and upwards. So it's really it was really lovely to have her on the pod. And yeah, it was great for her to feel comfortable enough to open up about some difficult times that she's had in recent years. And yeah, we really appreciate her doing that. And so yeah, we just wish her all the best for the future. And I know she's going to have a fantastic career.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think... you know, you make decisions in life sometimes and you might be a bit older. She talked about getting into comedy a bit older. I was a bit older getting into comedy as well. But do you know what? That things happen when they happen. And we've both still got many, many years in the game, in the comedy game. So, and yeah, she's really making waves as well in the industry at the moment. And all the stuff she's talking about with making venues more inclusive and gigs more inclusive is absolutely bang on. And I think, you know, in a way, along with someone like Sophie Harkin, I think Vix will be sort of leading that way, hopefully.
Yeah.
I'm not, actually, that's unfair because I don't want to put that pressure on her. But the fact that she's even talking about it, I think is hopefully making a change. So, yeah, someone that's really making waves in the industry.
Yeah.
And it was great having one. So do check out her Brighton Fringe show. Go and see her at the Edinburgh Fringe. Come and see me at the Edinburgh Fringe as well if you're going up there, although it's not till August. And, yeah, make sure she is someone that you get into your sphere, because she's a positive energy. And I think we all need that right now.
Absolutely.
And that's it. That's the end of this week's podcast. Giles, thanks very much for, I mean, just being you. I don't know why I say it, because you know I love you, but I just, I don't know.
Well,
it's nice
I love
to say
you too,
at the end
man.
Of each episode.
Well, likewise. And I'm excited because we're going to go to the football together.
Yeah, we are. We're going to go and watch Palace versus Everton.
So
yeah, in the FA Cup quarterfinals.
So I get to see you for the, in the flesh.
I know. We'll be watching obviously the team that we love probably lose, but it doesn't matter.
We're going to win.
We're doing well at the moment, and Everton are terrible at the moment. So unless they sack their manager in the next 2 weeks, hopefully we'll be okay. But yeah, looking forward to that. That'd be great. Anyway, our listeners, hope you're having a good time. I'm sure you enjoyed that episode. Thanks for all your tweets and book reviews and just getting in contact. We really appreciate it. We hope you have a wonderful week. We're back next week, of course, with another episode on the Blank Pod. But until then, take care. Look after yourselves. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you again very soon. Goodbye.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is a Blast Box Media Podcast.